Blog Talk Radio.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up, all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. If we just let it be, na 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 na, the world won't get no better. We gotta change it, girl, just you and me. Wake up, all the doctors, make
breaking up with Linda Mitchell.
You said it, girl.
Jimmy, yeah.
Through the land, we educate, communicate, and collaborate.
We
give, showing others how to live. We care, share, we love all through the land.
Well, good evening. Good evening. Good evening. It is Tilly Tuesday, and I hope you had a wonderful day today. You know, if you did not have a good day today, you will have a better day tomorrow. We have Miss Stephanie Haynes coming on with us, and we're still dealing in the segment of healing trauma. And we're talking about compassion here. But before we get started, I want to remind you of this. When we speak from our minds, we change minds. When we speak from our heart, we change hearts. And when we speak from experience, we change lives. And in order to do that, we have to recognize compassion. First, we have to have it for ourselves, because if you have never experienced it, you don't recognize it, and you don't know how to have it. So she's going to come on and let us know about it. But before we move further, you remember Miyoshi, what's up? She works with us as a host here. And her father passed away, Reverend John Edwards. And we'd like to send prayer to Miyoshi, what's up, and her family. And I remind her to always remember the thread that blends us on that note. Before Stephanie gets in, I'd like to tell you again to get involved in your community and the government to make the changes that have to be made. Gas prices are sort of like trickling down a little bit, but I noticed that this B12-1 COVID is going up. So continue to be aware, to be observant, to stay safe, and more so to stay woke. That's what we're all about here. I'm going to play you a little bit of this. We're going to kind of tune into this compassion and this healing trauma. Let me play a little bit of this. Just listen closely, and then we'll bring Stephanie in. Get your pads out.
About the school I seem to have, 'cause I'm just not
Yes, I blame you, because we do not want to blame ourselves for our shortcomings. And that's why Stephanie Haynes, the author of The Healing of the Wound and the author of The Healing of a Man's Heart, is here to go into a second segment of Healing Trauma. Stephanie Haynes, are you on the line with us this evening?
Yes, good evening, Ms. Linda and listeners. How everyone is doing this evening?
Well, Stephanie, we're fine that you're here, and you know I'm going to put it out here. Thank you with appreciation and gratitude to you for coming on, Karen, and sharing and educating us. I've already asked them to get out plenty of pads and pencils, because you know you will have a person with arthritis in their hand with the information and the education and the empowerment that you give. So we're happy that you're here, and I'm going to let you get started. I do have a question, so whenever you want to hear about it, I have some questions to come in that would be related to your topic.
Okay. All right. So last week, we left out self-compassion, right? Perfectionist doesn't make you feel perfect. It makes you feel inadequate.
Mm.
That's from Maria Shepherd. Perfection doesn't make you feel perfect. It makes you feel inadequate.
Whoa, okay.
Right, so self-compassion can also be a powerful source of strength, coping, and resilience. You know, one study of divorced couples, for example, found that the most reliable indicator of how they were doing 1 year post-divorce was whether they were a good friend to themselves. Similarly, for veterans just back from the combat, self-compassion was more predictive of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is called PTSD, than the level of combat exposure. So it's not what happened to us, but how we treat ourselves when times are tough. It comes down to whether we are most often enemy or ally. Now, this is what we talked about last week. So I had two questions. Question number one was, so why isn't self-compassion value in our culture? And why is it so hard for us to be our own best friend? Now, you may be thinking that it's more honest and honorable to be self-critical. Perhaps you see self-compassion as indulging, lazy, selfish, self-centered, or weak. What other misgiving do you have about self-compassion? Although we all need to have a realistic sense of our strengths and our weakness. That's not the same as being hard on ourselves. Now let's think of compassion as cultivating an inner strength that would help us every day. We become more resilient by learning to rely for encouragement and support, just as we rely on good friends in times of grief and to be consoled, or even as we celebrate, right? Now, for those of you who are curious about how self-compassionate you are, let's develop a 26-item self-compassion scale to measure self-compassion. Good news. Thinking that a shorter version might be useful given time constraint. Nurse and her team developed one with just 12 questions called the self-compassion scale. Now this is time, if you don't have your pens and paper, you need to go get it. All right. So, number one, that when I fail at something important to me, I become consumed by feeling of inadequacy. Number two, I try to be understanding and patient towards those aspects of my personality I don't like. Number three, when something painful happens, I try to take a balanced view of the situation. Number four, when I'm feeling down, I tend to feel like most other people are probably happier than I am. Number five, I try to see my failing as part of the human condition. When I am going through a very hard time, I give myself the caring and tenderness I need. I'm going to read that one again. When I'm going through a very hard time, I give myself the caring and tenderness I need. Number seven, when something upsets me, I try to keep my emotions in balance. Number eight, when I fail at something that's important to me, I tend to feel alone in my failures. Number nine, when I'm feeling down, I tend to obsess and fixate on everything that is wrong. Number 10, when I feel inadequate in some way, I try to remind myself that feeling of inadequacy are shared by most people. You're not by yourself. You're not alone. Number 11, I am disapproving and judgmental about my own flaws and inadequacies. Number 12, I am intolerant and impatient towards those aspects of my personality. And we do this all the time. I call this self-sabotaging too. But we're all human. We're all going to make mistakes. We're not perfect. Even those who even try to strive for perfectionists, you know, that never happens. Nobody's perfect on this earth. Now, we may be perfect as we are in this state, in this moment, for the conditions, for whatever we need to experience. Strive for perfection. You know, there's always going to be some bumps in the road. All right, just trying to line up all your ducks in a row. Somebody's always going to get out of line. So that's not going to work, right? So you may be wondering. Yes, Linda, you have a question?
No, I'm over here sniggling. Okay, no question yet.
Okay. So you may be wondering, what's the difference in between self-compassion and self-esteem? Now, self-esteem is defined as the positive and negative evaluation we hold about ourselves or how we feel about ourselves. Now, self-compassion, on the other hand, has all of the benefit of self-esteem without the drawbacks because it excludes self-criticism and is not linked to social comparison the way self-esteem is. You may be aware that the psychologist extolled the benefit of self-esteem until recent research linked the high self-esteem with narcissism, unstable self-worth, and distorted self-perception. Now, as Nurse described it, our self-esteem bounce up and down like a ping pong ball based on our latest success or failure. Self-compassion is there for us when we succeed, but it steps in precisely when self-esteem desert us and that when we fail. Or I humiliated in some way, then it's there to catch us. Passion is linked with fewer social comparisons and less contingent self-worth. Making fewer social comparisons can come in handy, especially when glimpses into others' world or social media or the internet, which increasingly compounds the negative effects of social comparison. We'll be discussing more on that later. So I'll be talking about this later. And I really feel for our youth that stays on social media 24/7, because what it's going to do is going to impair their social skills.
Mm.
Getting out there talking to others. Yeah, and most people now, they're socializing on the internet. So I really fear for our generation of today, of our youth, when it comes to social etiquette and the social norms. You know, those are things that would be left out because they hide behind the computer.
Yes.
Or the phone or the tablet.
Yes.
Now, between the stimulus and the responses, there is a space. And in this space lies our power and our freedom. Now, this is formal and informal practices. Now, we can be mindful of all and any aspect of our life experiences, including sensation in our body, the feelings, the thinking, the seeing, the smelling, the hearing, touching, and tasting. Ideally, presence would permeate as many of our moments as possible. A tall order for sure, but the point is that the presence of mindful awareness can become more and more a way of life, a baseline way of being. Now, research reveals that present is a learnable skill. Now, remember, it's a practice. After all, there are two complementary ways to realize this transformative potential of being present or mindful, formal and informal. Now, the formal practice has a specific form, including structures and durations. For example, include mindful awareness practices such as mindfulness meditation, which is yoga, tai chi, or qigong. Now, informal practices have no specific form, but are no less important than formal practices. Example, including feeling the rain on your face, being fully present for a conversation with a friend, or catching the sunset, attention to the nature light show. Now, the informal practices are important in realizing the full transformative potentials are present in our daily life. Now, I'll give you a scenario. Now, Tandy and her partner found themselves in a highly stressful situation when they had to evacuate their home because of a California wildfire. Now, she recalled packing essentials in the dark with no electricity and being so mindful with herself. The toothbrush and everything. Now, I had to know what things were and what I had to pack as we prepared to flee and move not only ourselves, but our new rescue dog, Soba Noodle, and the two cats, Ivy and Charlie, to the evacuation space. Cindy described the experience like a recess for her, as she was so mindful during the evacuation. And ever since then, she frequently asks herself, what am I doing at this moment? Because sometimes if we have to flee, we ain't thinking about what we're doing. We're rushing and trying to get whatever we need to get and get on out the house. But Tindy described the experience like a recess for her, as she was so mindful during the evacuation. And even since then, she frequently asks herself, what am I doing at this moment? Now, Tindy's story illustrates an informal mindfulness practice in an extreme situation. Now, what about doing a more ordinary day? What might that look like? Now, Amanda is in her mid-30s, a single mom of two children, working full-time as a speech therapist for her local school district. Now, volunteering at school and being the primary caregiver for her mother, who lives an hour away, she feels like a hummingbird managing so many things and fear being motionless for too long. Mm. So when she's at work, she tries to be fully present with her patients. When she's volunteering, she's trying to pay attention to the students and what's going on in the classroom. And she makes a special effort while driving to visit her mother to feel her hands on her steering wheel, being as present as she can during that 1 hour. Now, there are more things I'd like to share about Amanda. She feels guilty for not having a meditation practice because she knows it would be good for her. But for now, she tries as best as she can to set her intentions to be present for as many moments as possible. Now, Amanda is not alone in feeling guilty. Many other women who I interviewed express feeling guilty for not having a regular form of meditation practice. Now, Amanda described it this way. There is so much science that says I should meditate. That is quickly because another source of guilt, and it feels bad not to meditate, just as I feel guilty about not working out. Now, one more source of guilt is that the last thing any of us need, and I assure Amanda that her informal way of practicing mindfulness in her daily activities, such as feeling her hands on the steering wheel while driving, all support the strengthening a state of presence. No need to feel guilty. We can celebrate even one breath. You know, being present, especially in the midst of chaos, it's a practice. Because so many things can be going on at one time that we forget to be in the moment, to be present. Because if you can be present in the midst of the chaos, some of the things that we will say or do may not happen because we are in the moment. We understand the moment. We can process the moment. We're not in that fight or flight syndrome. So that's very important about being in presence. All right, so the informal is as important as the formal. So please don't despair if you don't have a formal mindfulness practice and aren't inclined to start one right now. It's okay. If you do have a formal practice, perhaps you can infuse as many moments as possible with presence outside of your formal practice time. You know, I would say while you're sitting in the car, instead of turning on your radio and your music, that's the time to focus. Even though when I do my morning prayers before I leave home, all the way when I get in the car, I put all the way from home to my destination, which is my job in the morning. And as I'm chanting, I am chanting for safety, for peace, for a harmonious workplace when I get to work, and to be my best so when I meet with my clients, they get 100% of me. So I am centered when I get to work. So, and that's my formal practice in the morning. You know, and it's sometimes when things get hectic for you, when you go to the restroom, to potty, whatever, take that time, take that little extra time in the restroom just to sit and meditate. You know, I remember when my kids was younger, and I used to come in from work, and I just say, just give me 30 minutes, and I just go into my room, and, you know, I had a bathroom in my room, and I just sit there and just de-stress, just let everything go before I go and, you know, and be with my children so I can give them 100% of me, and then I won't be yelling and screaming at them because I have not settled myself.
Right.
You know, so it's very important to be in the present when we are really dealing with our loved ones. That's very important. Now, I'm going to talk about Kelly, her situation. Now, Kelly, she is 39, tall, she poised, and eager to talk. Perhaps because of her relative solitary work days as a psychotherapist. Now, she walks into her office with her athletic stride. Now, I later learned she played college basketball. She had both confidence and cheerful. Kelly is the main breadwinner for her biculture and bilingual household. Her career consists of cobbling together a private psychotherapy practice, two teaching jobs, and a small business that grants continuing education credits to mental health professionals. Now, Kelly is now 8 months pregnant and finding that her resentment grows daily as her responsibilities expand with the intimate arrival of their second baby. Her spouse has a simpler life, as he not only has just one job to deal with, but returns home to fewer responsibilities than she has for the family and the home. Now, mind you, Kelly says that her mindfulness practice is what keeps her calm. Now, you heard all the stuff that I said about Kelly earlier, right? All the responsibility that she has. right?
Yes, yes.
So in consisting of taking 15 extra minutes in the bed when she first wake up each morning to listen to a meditation tape. Other times she meditates on her own. Kelly feels that the difference on those days when she doesn't take time for herself. And she adds, for me, more present means less anxiety. Now, Kelly also practiced mindfulness informally, slowing down by being aware of the sounds and whatever else is happening around her. Now, that's how I have always kept myself present. When she feels present, she describes feeling empowered. When she is fully present at work, for example, while with a patient or doing breaks between patients, she feels more connected and calm. Now, I had the pleasure of interviewing Kelly again after the birth of her second baby. Now, parenthood has taught her that things change so fast that there's no place to be but present. Now, Kelly realized on the morning of our second interview that her six-month-old daughter can now sit up and doesn't need to be propped up on a pillow. Part of parenting, she says, is being present in order to keep up with the development. Because most time when you have young babies and the mom is pregnant, that young child going to develop a little quicker to get out of the way for the next child. Now, Brooks called the brain a pleasure-seeking machine. As he explained, once we teach the brain that resting calmly in the presence feels better than a habitual state of seeking, then over time, the brain actually wants more mindfulness. Turns out that our level of well-being, which is the resiliency and impulse control, can be enhanced. Now imagine how refreshing it would be if you could replace your monkey mind morning with a more peaceful start, such as mindfully drinking a cup of tea or coffee, whatever your beverage it is in the morning, taking a walk, or some other practice that brings you an inner sense of calm. Now, the more experts we become, the less we see. The more experts we become, the less we see. When our brain receives stimuli, they do their job by first sorting all other stimuli that comes our way, then looking for patterns, and finally constructing categories and concepts in order to make sense of the input based on our previous experience. Now, this information flow can be called top-down processing. And it often serves us very well. Now, imagine if we had thought anew with everything we encounter in a day, for example. If you had to learn each morning how your coffee maker works or how to drive a car. Now, the researcher, psychologist Alan Langer, explains that actively noticing differences in the key to presence and that it is our expertise that gets in the way. Now, one way of understanding this is that a top-down processing means that our minds are filled with memories, stories, and experiences from childhood, which can sometimes imprison us and get in the way of our being able to have a fresh look at something. Now, ironically, the more expert we become, the less we can see, because our learning from past experiences filters our perception. So all the trauma that we have experienced in our past life, because it's the past, right? And sometimes we hold on to those traumas, and those traumas become our stories. And we begin to live those stories out for self-pity. We only really get truly blessed and get the things that we need is when we forgive ourselves, forgive the other person that transgressed against you, and move on. But sometimes it's hard for individuals to move on because it's embedded in their cellular system, the cells of their bodies, where they hold on it for so long that they are not able to process because the mind don't want to let it go. You know, I have a quote that when you heal the mind, the body will follow. We got to heal that mind. Right?
Yes.
But part of our eagerness to always fill in the blank is because our brain prefers answers over ambiguity. And we like knowing or at least thinking that we know. When we provide a story that allows the brain to protect us, it's happy, and we can enjoy a chemical reward for the story regardless of its accuracy. Now, this phenomenon explains in parts why just be present sounds so simple, and yet in practice it's so hard. To incorporate into our lives, getting comfortable with certainties and not knowing is part of our challenge. Not knowing is okay. Now, our family tells of the purple bag illustrations. What an amazing storyteller our brain is. Now, this is another scenario. Now, when Dan and I returned from a trip to San Francisco with Alex and Maddie, our then school-age children, we couldn't locate the purple carry-on bag that we always brought with us on our trip. Now, I felt I last saw it all packed up and ready to go at our front door before our trip. Now, Dan thought he remembered putting it in the car. And our kids thought they last saw it in our hotel room. Now, we retracted our steps. We searched our house and cars and called the hotel, but no signs of the purple bag. Now, one day, while looking for Maddie's volleyball shoe, I found the purple bag on the floor of the closet. Now, it turned out that the purple bag had never left the house. We were all shocked by this, and most of all, by the convincing stories that each one of us has created regarding the bag, our brains love stories. Truth aside, stories help us try to make sense of things and even help us socially construct and share views of reality as our family did with the missing purple bag. Now, how often do we do that? We create things in our mind that ain't nothing happened. And as they were saying, you are so dogmatic about it, right? And it's not even true. And it didn't even happen, right? But how many times we do that? I'm guilty. I can say I am guilty of that sometimes. You know, something when you get to be doing so much, and this is what happens when you're doing too much that you're not in the present in the moment, that things get so combobulated that you just thinking of making up stuff that it ain't even happening. Right? But by contrast, with the bottom-up processing, we receive and perceive input directly through our five senses, which is seeing, smelling, tasting, hearing, and touching. We can even feel what scientists call our sixth sense that interoption or our way of feeling the sensation of the body. This is a direct way of noticing, free of the filtering through the prior expectations or judgment. Language research shows that when we create a mindful state that can be understood as the bottom up, we experience spaciousness and an ability to see details, which in turn allow us to live more fully in the present. Nothing lasts, nothing is finished, nothing is perfect. I want you to write that down. Nothing lasts, nothing is finished. You know, we always say, oh, that is so perfect. Then come along, something happens that make it not so perfect. Now we're going to dispel in the myth. Now, what are the myths about ourselves and managing our lives that still have a hold on us? Write this down. This is a question that I want you guys to answer. What are the myths about yourself and managing your life that still have a hold on you? Now, when I started listening more deeply, not only to my own inner voice, but also to the women in my office, my interviewees, and women in my workshop, I realized that regardless of age and the stages, we all share similar challenges. We often find ourselves trapped in stories that have withstood the test of time, but not of truth. Now, we underestimate and downplay our abilities, our skills, and the myth of I am not good enough and its cousin, I don't deserve it, or alive and pervasive when it comes to women appreciating themselves and giving credit where credit is due. Now, one business consultant who I interviewed, who works extensively in the Silicon Valley, says she's shocked how prevalent imposters syndrome is in so many successful women who feel less than or incompetent. Now, Joy is now, this is another scenario. Now, Joy is a single mom, an occupational therapist, one of the most accomplished and capable women I know, who has worked in various while raising her two children. She is the one you can count on to host friends and families for holidays and birthdays, always managing to bring people together when no one else seems to be able to do it. Now, Joy declined to be interviewed for this book, but when I asked her why, she said, "I'm such an underachiever. Compared to what I could have done, I should be in a better place now." Now, does this sound familiar for some people or for yourself? Although men attribute their success to the core skills, women ascribe their success to being lucky, working hard, and having support from others along the way. Now, the males consistently overestimate their grade point average, while women underestimate, and when it comes to job hunting, women tend to not even apply for a job if that doesn't meet all of the qualifications for what the position is. Now, men, on the other hand, they apply if they meet only 60%. Furthermore, upon finding jobs, nearly 60% of men negotiate their first salary, while less than 10% of women do. All right, women, you got to work on that self-esteem, what were our self-worth, that self-compassion for ourselves. Now, this is another scenario, Anna. Now, Anna, she's 48 years old, has two teenagers, and works full-time jobs as a commercial architect and co-founded with her architect husband of a successful firm bearing his family name in Minneapolis. Now, Anna also teaches in the local university, the architectural program, sits on the city architectural review board, and does extensive networking that constitutes the firm's biggest revenue source. By all outward accounts, Anna has a successful career. Now, at the close of our interview, Anna asks if she could add one more thing. She leaned over and she whispered, "I have been a principal for years, but I never had a paycheck. For 20 years, but never had a paycheck." Now, she explained that their firm has always operated as a sole proprietorship under her husband's name, and she hasn't given a second thought until her interview. She reasoned that as long as she's married, she thinks she'll be okay. Now, regardless of our age, professional status, educational background, many of us continue to view our own power and worth in the world as less than. Now, that's the culturally construct story many women carry as a top-down filter that shape not only our belief and behavior, but also our sense of self. Now, before I left Anna that day, I recommended that she at least look into the possibility of forming a corporation and drawing a salary. So I'm happy to report that 2 months later, she let me know that she now receives a salary for the first time in her career. Now, how many of us, I know I wouldn't have done this. Well, I can take that back because I do give a lot of myself to the community freely. So let me take that back. I have done this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so many of us do.
Yeah.
We give of ourselves freely, right? For the betterment of the family, the betterment of the community, you know, but however, for those individuals who have been traumatized in their lives, some of them become fearful of asking for what they really need in their life. They don't feel worthy. They don't feel deserving. But we're going to peel back those layers of the pain, and that's why journaling is so important, down the things that we've been through to help heal those spaces in our lives so we can be able to move forward and to really enjoy life. Because if you didn't really know why we was really born, we were born to be happy, to have fun, to enjoy our lives, but also to do our purpose and our mission. Now, sometimes our karma is our mission, the things that we've been through, to be able to uplift another individual, to know, hey, I've been there too, and this is how I navigate through my trauma, my pain. Now, there are several other myths related to I am not good enough, including I am not smart enough. Take your pick. We often think there is something wrong with us if we can't keep up or what we aren't accessible the way we are. Now, this is how the story was constructed, from our social experience shaped our view of ourselves. Now, I ask the women whom I interview, regardless of age, what advice they would have for a woman of life. Their advice consistently reflects the myth we may hold. Don't be afraid to share your mask. Don't be afraid to share that mask. You are enough. And be who you are.
Mm-hmm.
How many of us wear masks? You know, in the healing of the womb, I talk about, you know, people wear masks for different occasions. And one of the questions I have in the workbook, can you name those masks? And how many masks do you wear? Because when you've been through a lot of trauma and pain, you cover up and you put that mask on because you don't want to show your true identity. You don't want to be vulnerable. So, don't be afraid to share that mask. You are enough. And be who you are.
I love it.
No, another myth. What'd you say, Linda?
I said I love it. I'm over here. I'm just smiling.
Yes,
I love
Now, another myth is that self-care is selfish. Okay? It's selfish. The term self-care to include self-compassion. Women often put others first, from family to friend to work, and believe that not to do so is selfish. Self-centered or self-important, both societal and culture expectation, as well as expectations from families, friends, and those we impose on ourselves, account for this. Now take a few moments now to let your most familiar myth come to your mind. For me, I can do it all. It's a healthy one, and the one I have struggled with for the most. It hunts me daily until I start interviewing women, you know, for this book.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that my generations own this myth. Surely the generation of women who have come after me, now in their 20s through their 50s, aren't trying to do it all anymore. I was wrong. It continued to be challenging for most of us to give ourselves permission to stop trying to do it all and all so well. The ongoing conversation we may have with ourselves around the I can do it all. A myth includes I'll get caught up this weekend. I have more time when this project is over. When I change jobs, when I finish my training, when dads move into assisted living, when both kids leave for college. Fill in the blank. What happens when those magical futures point in time become our present moment? Think about a time in your life when you thought you will enjoy more time. Did that come to pass? I hope it did. But most often it doesn't work out the way, as there's usually never enough time, much less more time. A few months after she had retired as a school administrator, my mother-in-law, Sue, said to me, "You will actually feel you have less time as you move through your life." Now, I didn't believe her then, as I was still deep in the trenches with young children and working full time. Now, I couldn't imagine a bruiser or more complicated life. I was wrong. Now, once we moved away from these destructive, non-productive, but powerful myths, these inadequacy stories, we can begin to stop feeling left in when our days or weeks don't feel balanced. How could they be balanced? After all, life is messy. Now, the takeaway is, expect and accept messiness. Expect and accept messiness. Our days are shaped by plan, commitment. Your children off at school, get to the office by 8, meet the plumber at your apartment, catch your daughter afternoon soccer game, pick up your car at the repair shop, visit your aunt who is in the hospital, cook a nutritious, delicious dinner, all in the same day, or even in the same week, or 3 weeks. But some version of this is exactly what many of us are trying to do day after day.
Mm.
Now, I remember, I have 6 kids. Sounds like me. And actually, this did sound like me. You know, it's a never-ending day,
mm-hmm.
especially for
mm-hmm.
me. And especially for women that have more than one children. Something that one child can run a person ragged if they don't know how to rear that child. And I'm not going to say control. I don't believe in controlling anyone. Nobody wants to be controlled, not even a dog. You teach them, you train them, and then they will respect you. They will listen to you. And then it will make your life easy to rear your children because they know when and when not to say or do certain things because you instill that into them. Now, the facts change, but the mystical parade of daily demands and expectations from ourselves and others persists. Now, there is no one simple answer or fix. And somatic social change is also critical in addressing these messages and myths. However, cultivating our capacity to be present, to see as clearly as we can, means moving one step further away from the magical pool of these myths and one step closer to more well-being. So how are we doing on time, Miss Linda?
Okay, I'm looking here. We okay. We got about 15 minutes to go.
Oh, okay. All right, so growing access to our most flexible self. Growing access to our most flexible self. Now, the neuroscientist Amisha Jha grew up in India, watching her parents practice meditation daily, to which she said, no thanks. Her resistance softened, however, when she observed her mother's resiliency after her father passing, Jha became curious about the science, the underlying meditation, and now spend her life researching the benefit of meditation. Now, primarily with groups of the first responders, student medical professionals, and the military. She practiced daily and mentioned that she was about to start her meditation recently when she called mom meditation.
Mm.
She phoned her mom in India, who has recently contracted dengue fever. And Jha explained that she was fully present for the call. It's the practice. It's a way of life. As director of her science lab, mom, the wife, the friend, the daughter, the sister, the lecturer, Jha understands well the demands facing women. Now, part of nature of what happens due to the demands upon us is that we are in a state of depletion of our cognitive resources, which translates to, for example, snapping at our kids. We don't want to do that. We know that it's not what they need right now, but we just want them to put their shoes on and leave the house for school. And I also said it's time management too, because you got to get your kids up and give them time to get ready.
Yes.
You know, and if you up late, and if you late getting up and getting them out, then yes, you're going to be snapping.
Everybody crazy.
You know, I have one daughter. My Ashley's my oldest daughter, right? Every morning, she'd be the last one. Everybody's up, ate breakfast, did their morning prayers, everything, right? She is the last one just to drag in it. And she'll be late to school. Everybody has to be on time, but she'll be late getting to her class.
Mm-hmm.
And so I asked her, and then when she gets to school, that's what she's like in kindergarten, right? She would have to stand in the corner. And so I asked her, I said, are you tired of standing in the corner? And one time I was her teacher. You know, I was her teacher, and was it preschool, kindergarten? I was a kindergarten teacher. Yeah. And it just amazed me how, and she couldn't call me mom in class. And she finally grew out of it. In kindergarten, she was fine. She was on time because of the fact that I was taking her to school and I was her teacher, so she was on time. But when she got into the second and third grade, yes. And so that as a parent, you know, even because I know I was the type of parent, I would have things, they get their, everything is laid out the night before. They get up early, 7 o'clock, to get their breakfast because they had to be at school by 8 o'clock, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what their routine. And then their bedtime routine, everybody, you know, come home, do homework, you know, may look at TV. It all depends on what the homework is, right? Bath, take your bath, eat your dinner. Go to bed, 7 o'clock. And so that's a routine. That's a schedule. I'll call it a schedule. You have to have that structure, especially when you have a large family. But if not, you'll find yourself in a state of not being present. And say, so I will used to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to set the tone for my day. I'll go work out. I do my morning prayers to get myself before I even get my children up to school. At 5 o'clock, I'm already got myself centered.
Right.
So I'll be able to handle my children without yelling and screaming. So when they can get to school, they won't be all scattered.
Mm-hmm. Very important.
And their nervous system is not shocked.
Right. Very important. Yeah. Very. Well, I'm listening and I'm loving this, and I'm looking at the numbers here, but this has been, Stephanie, this has been like a mind blower, and especially that top-down processing to the bottom-up. I think I'm a bottom-up person. At least I learned how to be. And the more I listen to you, I'll be able to journal real well tonight, and I hope other listeners will too. And I just wanted to touch back on, in your questions, we're going to go into segment 3 of this because we have to pick it back up because you were a parent with 6 kids. What about the women that have no kids? They still go through that too. So hopefully in our next segment, we can encourage that too. I'm not regimented. I've gotten out of that military mode. And I noticed that about myself. You know, I'll set my plan for the next day or what I have to do, and I get up and relax myself and have my tea, do my meditation, and relax down. And I say, well, you know what? I'm not doing all of that today. Okay? I'm going to push that to the next day. And at first you feel guilty about it because it's like you're pushing it out. But no, you're not pushing it out. You're taking care of you. Okay, what I look like riding around, running crazy, trying to go here. Let's take care of the top priority and then move on out, but pretty much relax in that, because presence to me is very important, and basically being present to myself, okay? If I know how to be present within, I can be present with you. And to wrap it up, we talk about compassion, and the young lady wanted the question, well, what is compassion? But you've answered all of that, but I started off, if you've never received it, you don't recognize it. So what is it? Some of us come through life and didn't have compassion for anything. We had to learn it, okay? But that was our mechanism of survival or whatever, because I'll tell people, I used to not have compassion. I had no compassion. Why didn't I have any compassion? So you think back, you think saying that you didn't get it, you was just giving it in a different way. They had compassion because you standing here. The compassion they gave you was to be independent, stand on your own, and keep moving forward. Okay, that's a compassion too. And that's something that was appreciated, but it was the way that I interpreted it, I guess. But that went out the way. But this segment here, talking about the top-down process and to the bottom-up, I'm loving it. I'm loving it. And then tolerance of different personality, I want to discuss further on that next segment. I highlighted it here when you were going into those 12 questions, and you said something about intolerance of personality. What did you mean by that?
You know,
It was in the question.
Yes. So tolerance in, let me go back to the question you're talking about. That was in the 12 compassions, right?
Yes. Compassions. Yes. Yes.
Okay. And I'm sure, okay. I am tolerant and impatient towards those aspects of my personality I don't like. Is that what you're
thinking of? That's the one I saw. Yes. Yes.
I am intolerant and impatient towards those aspects of my personality I don't like. Now, I always tell individuals, the things that you don't like about yourself, nobody can change those things but you.
Well, when you're in a problem with me, that's probably why I highlighted it, because when you have 52 personalities like I do and know of them, that's kind of difficult. And I remember, and I'll share this, and we're going to move on out. I took a transformational workshop. It was like the military. And we were in this room, and we had to go to these group of people. And as we were moving around the room, as we got to each group, they put a question out there, right? And nobody knew anyone. We were in there to do a thing. And when I got in front of my group, and the question was, what I don't like about myself, I looked at those people, Stephanie, I said, it's not nothing I don't like about myself. You know, they cursed me out. They wanted to know, who did I think I was? I told them. I just had to be honest. I can't figure it. Did I think I was? I said, I don't have to think about it. I know who I am, okay? And they moved me on down to the next group, right? But I when you said that, I had flashbacks on that, because that's the way I answered it, because that's the way I felt, okay? So I don't know what y'all feeling like or what you in here for, but there ain't nothing I don't like about myself. And I guess they were not ready for that answer. They lit into me, and I told them what I had to say, and they moved me on down the road. Okay, so when people talk about, and you know, I do a lecture on my personalities. I talk about my 52 personalities. We'll go through that one time, and people are on the floor, but they are real, and they're all true, and I have them in sections. So I guess when we say top down to bottom up, I guess I possibly fall into that bottom up category. This has been very, very interesting. We're going to carry this through for next week. And my, oh, before I let you go,
won't
Friday the 15th. I'm sorry?
Yeah, we'll be doing it for the whole month of April.
I love it. Now, the 15th, you're doing Grown and Sexy. Is that correct?
Yes, this Friday. We're doing Grown and Sexy.
Yes.
This Friday.
Yes, I have it. I have it. We're going to try to, I don't know if I'll be able to schedule around, but I put it out there, and I'm going to try to attend. But on that note, Stephanie Haynes, the healing of the womb, the mind, and getting it together, giving people arthritis, because say you will, I got five pages over here. I got five pages with my highlights. And what I'm going to do is, you have answered the question that came in on that. And I like what you said about there is, where is it? No end. I'm trying to find it. I got so many pieces of paper over here because you will have a person flipping and writing. And then listeners, if you have any sense, keep you a file of Stephanie Haynes because you can always refer back to it. And nobody is perfect. We know that. And, you know, you want to know the facts and working in social change, see clearly, moving always, and keep a flexible self. Those are things that I highlighted. I'm going to remind them again. You know, always be flexible. Sometimes people, you know, they want to say that, well, I have a lot of stubbornness about me, and that's okay, too. But the way I get out of it, because, you know, I got something to say. Oh, you're stubborn. I say, no, I'm not stubborn. I just move low and slow and let them figure out what I'm talking about. Okay, because just because the water's over there bubbling don't mean I need to stick my toe in it right now. I want to see how many bubbles is in it before I'm going to stick my toe in it, but I have to move it in the manner that I need to move it in. So that stubbornness about that, but your value, we learn how to say, excuse me, I don't think so. No, that's not going to work for me. Oh, we want to train you. I want to say, when I hide in the world, are they going to train me? Are you looking for a trainer? But I become humble. You got me? No. It don't go that way. So you got a lot of things happening out here. Women, stand up. Listen. Value yourself. Do the self-compassion. Learn compassion for you, and therefore you can recognize what others need. I'm going to end this, Stephanie Haynes, with you and I always say, when you light a candle for others, our path become brighter. You got us lit up over here. The cave is lit, okay? Sometimes it can stay dark for thousands of years, but all we need is that one candle lit, and you are our candle lighter. And on that note, we're going to say thank you, thank you, thank you, Stephanie. I'm putting it out. I'll resend the link out there, and hopefully I can join on Friday. I don't know if I can, you know, schedule it around. I got some callers in. And some, you know, usually Friday we do the show. And if they're willing to come in earlier, I don't know. I'll have to check it out. But I've let others know. So if I'm not there, somebody will be there, okay?
All right.
Stephanie Haynes, the author of The Healing of the Wound and many, many, many other things, working in the community for years and years and years and, you know, just putting it out there, others, but I'm hearing what you're saying because when they call and ask me to volunteer, I ask them to give me this part, man, okay? I just can't do it. Not right now. Okay, you have to put your foot down at some particular time. So that's basically where I am. I guess I'm increasing my value. It might be being arrogant, but whatever it is, send me that check, okay? That's what time it is. When you volunteer 20, 30 years, you need a paycheck. Like the lady said, she never got a paycheck. Paychecks are needed. It's not all about the money. It's all about your worth. Wouldn't you say so?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
All right. And on that end, we're going to say have a great night, Stephanie. We love you. Thank you.
Love you too,
Stephanie.
Thank you. Have a
how to live. We care, share, we love all through the land.